Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. While the federal eviction moratorium has ended, the need to make rent payments has not. By some estimates, 30 to 40 million Americans could be on the precipice of receiving eviction notices soon. Many already have. Leticia Gonzalez is one of those Americans. She lives in Cleveland, Ohio, and she joins us now. And Leticia, what went through your mind when you received an eviction notice from your landlord just last month? What happened?
Well, the first thing that kind of went through my mind was just homelessness. I have two small children, and I was just concerned with, due to COVID-19, a lot of shelters have kind of closed down or they limited the amount of people that are allowed into the facilities. So I was just worried about even having anywhere to go with me, having my kids.
You were worried about that. I presume you still are worried about that?
No, actually, when I had received it, I was ready in process of trying to find an essential job. There's a lot of essential jobs available to people. I was trying to stay at home and just stay safe and stay as healthy as possible. But when you have to pick between completely having nowhere to stay or, you know, just going out and getting a job, like I had the lesser of two evils, I guess.
So the lesser of two evils being
risk myself getting sick, or yeah, I stay at home and risk myself getting evicted and being ultimately homeless
on the street with your children, right? So the reason why you had faced that eviction notice was that you weren't able to pay rent for a couple of months.
Yes, I had stopped working. At the end of March. And I did have a little bit of funds that kept me afloat. And then I paid April with the stimulus check that was provided and also bills and just necessities that was needed for my home. But, you know, those things don't last. They didn't really last much longer than that. So I paid a portion of May with the same stimulus check, including the April rent. And I spoke to him periodically and I tried to explain to him, I'm looking for a job. I'm trying the best that I can. He didn't really want to hear it so much. It was just more about, I need the rent, which I understand, but I'm trying as best as I can. I actually got a call back from Amazon July 9th. I had started working there. So when he posted it, it was July 4th. So it was kind of, I didn't have the funds already because I had just got the job. So I still needed July to even accumulate the funds to pay him.
I see. So Amazon being the job that you took in order to help make ends meet.
Yes. Oh,
yeah. And what do you do at Amazon?
I'm a single packer. So anything you get where you just ordering one thing, I'm probably your girl that's packing.
What's it like?
It's a strenuous job. It's hot, and then, you know, I'm standing for 12 hours, but at the end of the day, it's what I need to do to take care of my family. And I'm the kind of girl that I'm not going to wait and for someone to care. I'm going to care about myself first. I've always been that way. I was raised by a single mother, and I never made excuses for myself, and I wasn't going to start now.
You know, I hear you, Leticia, when you say that. However, this is a circumstance in which I wouldn't say it's an excuse. I mean, the reason for your pain and tens of millions of Americans' housing distress right now has nothing to do with their ability to take care of themselves, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. I understand it completely. It's just, I guess, definitely with a lot of America, they have way more higher bills than me. Also, I think a lot of people don't consider that. Like with me, I have a small apartment, you know, I live in a duplex. I don't I can't really, like, I don't have as much bills as everyone else does, but I tried as best as I could. I saved all the money that I had, but virtually it left me with nothing. If I didn't have food stamps and I didn't have those things, I wouldn't even probably be speaking to you about that. I'd probably be working on getting myself evicted.
Yeah.
So it's the little things that mattered, you know?
Yeah. You know what? I actually, in listening to you, I really appreciate what you're saying, because life is complex, and I'm hearing you talk about your personal sense of responsibility, and also even with all of that, the help that you needed in order to keep a roof over your head and food on your family's table.
Yeah, because I'm the only one. I'm, you know, I care about them the most.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, what other kinds of help do you need? Do you feel like you're housing secure for the foreseeable future now?
Okay. I'm definitely, I'm having people reach out to me, and especially now that the article has went on, just people me explaining my story in further detail. I think that's what has a lot to do with it too, is just, so people don't know the ins and outs, because I'm like on the bottom tier. I'm right before being homeless. So a lot of people kind of don't understand my situation, as well as, like, I wish I could explain more.
Mm-hmm.
I have kids, and I'm a single mother, but like I have like family matters. And there's a lot of kind people out here that are just reaching out to me and just telling me that I'm not alone and that they're willing to help. So I thank God for those people. And just, I also just having faith, it helps a lot. And a lot of people, you know, some people in these times right now don't believe it, but just believing in yourself. Mm-hmm. That's all you need.
Can I ask another question about the help that you tried to get before you got that job at Amazon? Because you mentioned the stimulus check. What about unemployment?
Oh my goodness. Unemployment is a circus. It is a complete, like, it's, I know I can't speak like that. So like, it's a show. It's a big show right now. The best way to explain it, when I went onto the website, there's a lot of terminology, a lot of things that they explain on there that I don't have a formal education, so I don't understand what they're saying. And then I'm trying to understand, because they said they allowed it, but they didn't put it through. And then it was just a lot of like gray areas, I would want to say. And I just feel like with these situations, it needs to be black and white. Everybody's struggling right now. A lot of people do not understand what you're saying on the website, and it can get very frustrating. And I just reading it, if let's give it to a person that doesn't have a high school diploma. My brother, I have my older brother doesn't even know how to read properly, and he is a grown man, and he's working and he's going through this right now, and he couldn't even apply. So I think that's another thing that needs to get taken into consideration when they say they want to offer all this assistance, but they literally make you go jumping through hoops just to get it, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So unemployment was a maze that you couldn't get through.
Yes.
You do have this job at Amazon now, 12 hours packing boxes though. And I understand you're also getting a little bit of rental assistance or some rental assistance from a local group. Is that right?
Yes. They said they were going to be reaching out to me today, later on, and they are going to try to help me with, you know, future rent payments and whatever help or assistance that I may need. And I thank God for those kinds of facilities. I wish that they would give them more funds so they can kind of give them out as needed, because without these places caring about us, like the people at the bottom, like it would be a lot harder. And I just wish people had more understanding of it. I wish there was more information getting sent out to homes about what they can do to save themselves from ultimately getting evicted.
Yeah. So that's CHN Housing, the group that we're talking about. I got one more question for you, Leticia, if I could. It's actually great news to hear you say that you feel a more confident about your housing situation, at least for the coming months. Your mom also, as you mentioned, there's got to be other expenses there. I mean, what about childcare? What's school going to look like? I mean, do you have all your bases covered?
Okay, so what we're going to do is because I spoke with my mother and I spoke with my children's father, and what we're going to do is I'm going to continue working nights, and I'm going to basically teach them Monday through Friday. And then Friday is going to be a little bit harder because I'll be tired from the previous night, but you got to do what you need to do for your kids. You know, like, I don't want them to fall behind. My son is very smart, and he deserves to have the proper education. Even if he doesn't have a teacher there, I'm willing to do that for him.
Mm.
Even though my education isn't too great, but you know, we can do it together.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're having this conversation today because that federal eviction moratorium has passed. There's no agreement yet between Congress and, well, between the parties in Washington about another round of assistance for Americans, whether it's unemployment assistance, another eviction moratorium, et cetera. No agreement yet. What do you think you need? What, if you had the ear of political leaders, what would you ask them for?
I would ask them to stop arguing, because it's really easy to try to argue on top of the hill, because I'm at the bottom of it. And I just want them to figure it out. Because at the end of the day, them arguing on top of the hill is nothing but kicking dirt down here to the rest of us. And I need them to learn to come to what's best for the many instead of caring about what's important for the few.
Well, Leticia Gonzalez, speaking to us from Cleveland, Ohio. Her landlord had issued her an eviction notice last month, but you heard how Leticia has pieced together a solution, at least for the foreseeable future, to keep a roof over her head for now. Leticia, thank you so much for joining us today. Well, we are talking about the coming eviction crisis, the similar challenges that tens of millions of Americans are facing, as Leticia has. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what could be a coming eviction tsunami across the United States as the federal eviction moratorium has lapsed. I'm joined now from New York by Emily Benfer. She's a health justice lawyer and visiting law professor at Wake Forest University. Earlier this month, Emily co-authored a report that estimates some 30 to 40 million Americans are at risk of eviction. We have a link to that report at onpointradio.org. Emily is also co-creator of the COVID-19 Housing Policy Scorecard with the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Emily Benfer, welcome to On Point.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So, first of all, I wonder if you could just reflect with us a little bit about what we heard in Leticia's story. before the break. She's seems to be holding things together for now. But how does Cleveland as a whole score on your on the COVID-19 housing policy scorecard in terms of protections for renters?
So Ohio and Cleveland both score very low, in great part due to the fact that Ohio as a state never instituted a statewide eviction moratorium, and it joins 30 other states in having no state-level protection against eviction for renters. Cleveland itself, they had a slight moratorium that ended mid-June, and since then, evictions have started to spike. But Letitia was actually one of the lucky tenants in that Cleveland is one of only five cities nationwide that has a right to counsel. And it's critical for tenants in this situation to be represented by attorneys because traditionally 90% of tenants are unrepresented and their rights go unrealized and they often are evicted as a result.
And so are there, what's the sort of opposite end of the spectrum there? What are the places that score higher and that you believe have better protections for renters?
So the states like Massachusetts and Connecticut have very high scores on the COVID-19 housing policy scorecard because they've stopped all stages of eviction and they are giving tenants time to pull the rent together to cover the back rent. And they're also providing rental assistance to families. Ohio as a state has not provided any rental assistance across the statewide level, which is what's keeping people from homelessness and housing instability and the long-term consequences.
And so in the absence of that state level protection or assistance, the fading away of federal level assistance is having a huge impact on renters in those states.
Absolutely. Across the country, we saw nearly 50 million Americans filed for unemployment insurance, and those rates fluctuated between 11.1% to 14.4%. By comparison, unemployment peaked at 10.7% during the Great Recession. So today we're seeing this widespread unemployment across the country. And the unemployment insurance, the extended unemployment insurance, was really the only thing keeping people from eviction if they didn't have a state level or local moratorium in place.
Okay, so let's talk more about this truly astonishing number that that your report estimates. That 30 to 40 million Americans, 10% at least, or around 10% of the nation's entire population, is at risk of eviction. How do you come by that number?
So the number is based on the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. And one finding out of that that I find particularly troubling that I think captures Letitia's story, 43% of families who rent have reported that they can't meet next month's rent. So these families are making the impossible choice of exposing themselves to COVID in what is left of the limited job market or exposing their families to the virus through homelessness, which leads to overcrowding and doubling up and a whole host of health problems in the long term. But the 30 to 40 million is...
Well, actually, Emily, can I just jump in here for a second? So I want to underscore what you just said. 43% of American families, 43% of American families say they may not be able to make next month's rent. Is that what you said?
Of American families who rent, that's correct.
Who rent, may not be able to make next month's rent.
Right.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be taken aback by those numbers because that is the reality that this pandemic has revealed. We can't hide from it anymore, but it still sickens. Honestly, it sickens me to hear that. That is a huge number. That's a huge part of this country. I mean, what is the impact of that? What is the meaning of that number?
It's nothing but a downward spiral. It means that we are determining the fate of generations to come. The outcomes of eviction are severe and long-term. They affect financial and personal well-being. They result in failing credit scores, a downward move, unemployment, residential instability. For children, it's a trauma. It results in emotional decline and academic decline. And this is going to take a long time to recover from and could be this second wave public health crisis on the heels of the pandemic.
Do you think political leaders are seeing the long-term effects, this wave that will pulse through generations of Americans. Do you think that they're alert to that?
If they are, it says something horribly wrong about our nation. The health outcomes alone will lead to such high healthcare expenditures and societal costs. The rent is what enables property owners to pay property tax, which enables them to pay their mortgages and avoid foreclosure. It sustains school systems and local and state governments. I mean, the housing market is a house of cards, and you pull out the rent, you start with unemployment, widespread unemployment, and the whole thing will topple over, and it will affect all of our communities in the long run. So ignoring that, remaining in this impasse, withholding federal financial relief for rent, withholding a nationwide moratorium, is setting up individuals and children for long-term harm and failure.
Hmm. Well, Emily, stand by here for just a second, because I want to play a clip from an On Point listener. This is Barrett, who called us from Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
I am going to be leaving the Cape within the next week, partly due to the lack of resources available on the Cape for someone like myself with a history of disability. And one of the things that I think is important to point out about the impending eviction crisis is not just all of the people who had jobs and lost them and are now facing the difficulty of trying to maintain their homes, but also all of the people that were already laboring under difficult circumstances, whether it be health conditions or taking care of multiple family members, and now facing the prospect of losing their very homes.
That's On Point listener Barrett, who called us from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Emily, stand by here for just a second, because I want to introduce into the conversation now, from Houston, Texas, Josephine Lee. Josephine is an organizer with the community-based workers' rights group El Pueblo Primero. Josephine, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Thank you for having me.
So can you give us a sense, give us a picture of what the eviction crisis or soon-to-be crisis might be looking like there in Houston?
Yeah, so I think it started in the early May. That's when Governor Abbott of Texas pushed the economy to reopen, and he pushed the economy to reopen without any health or housing protections in place. In fact, even striking down mask mandates from local governments, such as here in Houston. Our statewide moratorium ended in May 18th. And since then, even though now we are in this health crisis, we've had no moratorium, no type of eviction protection in place in Houston. The mayor put together this housing stability task force, but then put the real estate industry in that task force. And so now you can see that even though our local city council members and housing advocates support some kind of eviction protection, our mayor still refuses to put it on the agenda. And so what we've seen, because our organization is mostly in communities of color in Houston, largely Latino immigrant communities, and they have been the hardest hit by this pandemic. 52% of hospitalization and deaths in Texas are from the Latino immigrant community, which has been largely shut out of government relief. Many have had to move in with families and friends, making it so much easier to contract the virus because they can't afford rent, right? Or they're facing eviction, or they've been forced to go back to work in unsafe conditions. And also, they don't have the health insurance to be able to afford treatment. So we see that the housing crisis is contributing to the larger health crisis here in Houston. And so, you know, we have members that have been sleeping on church benches, in their cars, on bus station benches. And we held a protest a few weeks ago to call for the expansion of relief, to call for suspension of rents. But the city responded by only expanding relief, but mainly through landlords. So it's basically like a bailout to landlords. And then we see that the landlords take this money, but then the next month after they take the money for the tenants' rent, they are evicting tenants. So they've been padlocking people's doors. So we've been seeing like mothers and children locked out of their homes. They've been charging exorbitant late fees, as much as $30 a day, which basically amounts to the tenant's rent per month if they don't pay for a month.
Yeah.
And so at the same time, they're taking this public money, right? This bailout from the city. They're also turning around and squeezing tenants for as much profit
right.
as possible.
So, Josephine, can I just jump in here on yeah. for a second? Because you're bringing up a really important point here. And I want to explore with both you and Emily for a couple of minutes here. Because historically, when we've said the word landlord, it's been, you know, rental ownership has been a place of sort of mom and pop businesses. We had been talking about small landlords. And of course, across this country, there still are many, many small landlords who I'm guessing are sort of dealing with their tenants hopefully on a more one-to-one basis. It's a different sort of calculus there with the small family-owned properties. But the difference now is what happened after the financial crisis in 2008, right? I mean, part of the recovery plan from the Obama administration, we should say, was allowing major investors, private equity, et cetera, to buy up foreclosed homes from Fannie Mae, right? I mean, in some zip codes, I was reading, for example, in Atlanta, from some zip codes, 90% of the distressed housing stock in those zip codes was bought by private equity, right? And so we have a situation now where in many, many places in this country, and I'm wondering if Houston is one of those, when we talk about landlords, we are talking about corporations.
Exactly. So even right now, during the pandemic, you know, there's speculators and developers that are taking advantage of the housing crisis, right? And taking advantage of the low interest rates to like buy up distressed properties, right? And to turn a profit on it. And so the landlords that we're dealing with, they're not these small landlords, right? That only have like a few tenants. I mean, they're huge developers that own dozens of properties across the country, and sometimes foreign, right, developers and speculators. And so they are obviously still able to profit during this time. So it's not a matter of being able to pay property taxes, right, or mm-hmm. being able to pay for maintenance. I mean, this is just pure greed, right? They're trying to squeeze as much profit as they can from their tenants.
Yeah. Well, Emily, I was reading that this is a problem, or this situation existed even before the pandemic. Atlanta just is really attracting a lot of my attention over the past couple of months, actually. But that in some places in Atlanta, these large corporate or Wall Street based owners of rental properties, were the Atlanta Fed found that they were 20% more likely to evict their tenants. So, like, even before the pandemic, the eviction rate in these those properties was much, much higher.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's actually this epidemic of serial filers where they file hundreds of evictions at a time. And in fact, in most of the cities where we're tracking, the eviction lab at Princeton University is tracking real-time evictions, we haven't seen those yet. And we expect that as soon as those serial filers pick up again, we will start to identify this avalanche happening in real time. The mom and pop landlords is a really good point. They own about 22.7 million of the 48.5 million rental units in the housing market, but more than half of them, 58%, do not have access to lines of credit. So when the rent goes unpaid, they don't have the cushion to weather that storm and to pay their mortgages. So they are at high risk of foreclosure, and with them goes those affordable housing units. In fact, we lost 4 million affordable housing units after the Great Recession and the foreclosure crisis.
Well, in fact, I just want to continue with that for a second. I want to play a little bit of tape that we received from a couple of small scale landlords. This is Richard from Baltimore, Maryland.
As soon as the eviction moratorium was announced, two of the four tenants, and remember, nobody lost their jobs or their income, stopped paying rent. So they are exploiting the pandemic, and they are creating a terrible situation for small landlords. I can't speak for larger landlords who may have enough properties to cover the difference, but I have four properties and two are not paying any rent. The last time I was paid rent was in February.
So that's Richard from Baltimore. Josephine, did you want to respond to him? I mean, he sees people taking advantage of the moratoriums.
I hear that argument from some landlords. We've actually had to call up landlords on behalf of our members. And so, you know, I deal with a lot of the property owners myself, and we hear that, but I don't think anybody is purposely, right, taking advantage. I mean, we're living in a crisis of no fault of anybody's own, right? People that we're in touch with, I mean, they are putting themselves at risk to try to make rent. They're going to work in unsafe conditions to try to make rent. And then, you know, all of that money is not given to even to pay for food, right, for their family. It's given directly to the landlord. And so I think there needs to be some kind of questioning of what of that message too. I think when it comes down to it, like a lot of your other guests have said already, is that it's from top down, right? The government has shown that they don't care about regular people, right, from top to bottom. And then so unless the government steps in and it is accountable to working people, I don't think we're going to get out of this crisis. Right now, it's just complete negligence.
Well, we are talking about the coming eviction crisis. Josephine Lee joins us, as does Emily Benfer. We'll talk about potential solutions when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow marks the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. So we're going to be taking a look at women and voting tomorrow. Of course, the 19th Amendment was the beginning, not the end of the work of suffrage, complete suffrage for women, specifically women of color, took a while longer. But since then, in the century since then, women have become the most important voters in the American electorate. I'm just going to make that argument right now. So what do you think of that? What do you think is the importance of the women's vote or votes in elections locally, nationally? What role do you think they're going to play this year in November? What are your questions about universal women's suffrage, about the history of it and where we are today? Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 with your stories and your questions. That is for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the coming eviction crisis that could sweep across the United States as both state and the federal level of eviction moratorium have ended. And I'm joined today by Emily Benfer, health justice lawyer and co-author of a new report that estimates some 30 to 40 million Americans are at risk of eviction. Josephine Lee also joins us. She's an organizer with the community-based workers' rights group El Pueblo Primero. She's in Houston, Texas. And I want to take a moment now to go to Kansas City, Missouri, because back in May, when we first did a show about evictions in America in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, we spoke with Tiana Caldwell. She was facing eviction in May, and here's what she told us then.
I feel bad for my family because I feel like my medicine is consuming all the resources that we have. And it's vital. And these are the problems that millions are facing across the country. You shouldn't have to decide between in a pandemic and an emergency and something you did not create. You shouldn't have to decide between your vital medication and food or rent or whatever your child may need.
That's Tiana Caldwell when she first spoke to us about facing eviction in May, and she joins us again now. Tiana, welcome back to On Point.
Hello. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you so much for coming back to the show. You had an eviction notice in May when you talked to us. We wanted to check back in with you. Are you still in your home?
I am still in my home, but it has been a struggle from month to month. Eviction was filed on me again just in July. And it was after I had made an arrangement with my landlord and actually paid the agreement. And as soon as the eviction moratorium lifted, he forgot all about the agreement that we made and just decided that since he could ask for rent in entirety, that he would. And eviction courts were back in so he could get me back in court, and he did. Luckily, I had a chance to get representation, and my case was dismissed. So I'm lucky for now. But now we're looking at in a couple of weeks for September 1st to be coming up, and rent will be due again. It's been a struggle every month. I panic every month about this time. It's a constant worry.
Oh, wow. I'll be honest, Tiana. Perhaps just the naive part of me was hoping to hear that, like, you had somehow managed to find some stability. But, like, I get it. Like, it seems like it's not going to happen anytime soon. I mean, your husband, when we talked to you last time, because of the pandemic and your health concerns, he was sleeping in the car, right? In order to keep you safe. Is he still doing that?
He is still taking major precautions. He is stripping at the door, making sure that things get bleached and sprayed down. We have a disinfectant spray. His job is really good about having those type of supplies, but we're scared. You know, there's always a possibility. What if we're not doing enough or if he is getting exposed and we're not doing enough to kill the infection that may slip through a crack or two. But we also have to survive. He can't sit by and watch his family become homeless, especially with the risk that and the vulnerability that I have to this, to the COVID.
He's got, he got a new job, right? Is it a better paying job?
It is, and that's why it's so vital that he does do this. It's hard and confusing for our son, our 13-year-old son, you know, to be living apart and to, you know, he knows that there's a risk, but you know, it's hard to explain that in a normal crisis, you come together. And in this one, it's so vital to keep distance. I mean, how do you explain that to your child when it's scary and it feels safer for the family to be together? But there's a risk. So it's hard to explain. School's about to start up. We do have the virtual option there for some semblance of security for my son, who is also terrified. He knows the risk. For me, and he's scared for his mom. He won't hang out with his friends. I try to encourage him to do something because I feel so bad, but he understands, and he's disciplined. He won't put his mom at risk, and it's changed our whole lives.
Wow. You know, when we first talked to you in May, we got an avalanche of response from listeners who wanted to help, and what I think one listener even wanted to hosted a virtual concert fundraiser for you. Now,
yeah,
you know what
you
I mean? That
very
that
much amazing listeners,
and you know my thanks to them. However, of course, at the same time, like, you know, keeping people, giving people stable housing through listener-based fundraisers or GoFundMes. I mean, that's not really a systemic solution for the suffering that people are feeling in America. Now, you had been part of a housing advocacy group in Kansas City. Has the group been able to? Yeah, has Casey Tennis been able to make any progress in getting more protection sort of reinstituted there for renters?
We are still working on that. But in the meantime, we have been showing up in court. We did a disruption to and was able to actually on July 30th, we were actually able to shut down eviction court, all four of the courts in Jackson County because of a demonstration, a disruption we did. Two of our comrades, Maya and Janae, put themselves on the line and were arrested. They knew the risk and they wanted to take it anyway. To make the point, we're arresting that demonstration. It did get attention and we are being heard, but we have not had any policy changes or any government action to protect the people. And this is not the environment to be homeless in. We know that homelessness is a problem. That's why we've created shelters and things like that. But in this pandemic, it's not a safe place to be in crowded areas where people are put in the same place. And so you have an issue of what do people do in these situations. But you have the go-ahead or the green light for landlords to put them out on the street. And we know it's not safe for them or for the rest of us, because what this crisis has shown us more than anything is that we're all more connected than we know.
Well, you heard one more question for you, Tiana, and thank you again so much for coming back and staying connected with us. You heard Emily Benfer a little earlier talk about how there will be a long-lasting impact of all this instability on families. I'm wondering if I'm hearing you say that for like month to month, there's this uncertainty that's become part of your life. What is the impact going to be on your family, on your kids?
It's limitless depending on how long this lasts. I mean, the damage done so far already has us in rebuild mode and the resources are not there to rebuild. You know, the 50% of all Missouri renters, that's like, I mean, 50% of Missouri, for the most part, are renters. 361,000 Missouri rental households are currently unable to make rent. That's several percentage points higher than the national average. Over the next few months, an estimated 243,000 evictions will be filed across Missouri. So I don't know what will happen to all these people, but that is a huge chunk of human beings who will be at risk, who will put us all at risk, who will possibly continue to spread this COVID crisis. And none of us need that. We need a government response. We need to protect ourselves. We need to protect the people. We need to protect us all.
Yeah. Well, Tiana Caldwell, a renter and mother in Kansas City, Missouri. Tiana, thank you so much for coming back to the show. And if it's all right, we'd love to check back in with you in a couple months again.
Yes, please do. And I would like to say that all evictions, regardless of a crisis, are violent. It displaces people. It disrupts their whole lives. We need to find a way to make our people stable so that we can all live a full life. Thank you.
Well, Tiana, thank you again. So Emily and Josephine, let's spend the last couple of minutes of the show here talking about possibilities, solutions. I mean, there's a crisis unfolding right now. So Emily, where would you begin? What's the first most urgent thing that you think policymakers at the federal and state level ought to do?
So the most important thing we can do right now is the emergency crisis response. We have to stop evictions from occurring. Just like Tiana and Leticia said, this is about having a full life. This is about being able to access opportunity to provide for your families and to prevent long-term harm. And to emphasize, 30 to 40 million people in the next few months. In 1 year, we usually see about 3.7 million eviction filings. So this is an astronomical level of evictions that our country has never seen, and it requires immediate rental assistance to keep people housed and not shift the burden to property owners, especially small property owners who lack the safety net. At the same time, like we heard about the self-help evictions earlier in the show, those are increasing across the country. So we need a nationwide eviction moratorium in place. So that's the first and foremost step that Congress must do in them as quickly as possible to protect the most families and individuals across the country from grave harm.
How much time do you think Congress has in order to do something before the wave starts?
I mean, I think they're out of time with the loss of the federal moratorium, with the executive order that did not include a moratorium, and the loss of extended unemployment insurance. People are desperate. They are not able to make ends meet. There's been a 92% increase in daily rental assistance, a 2,000% increase in food pantry requests in some states so that people can shift any funds they have to the rent, a 31% increase in credit card usage to pay the rent. People do not have the ability to provide for their families, to keep a roof over their head at a time where it could never be more critical to have a home.
Mm. So I'm hearing you call for like a two-part immediate action, the moratorium and rental assistance to keep some liquidity moving through the system here, especially as you're saying for those small landlords. The second part can really, I'm presuming, only mostly come from the federal government because, Josephine, as we know, many states right now, they're running out of money or are out of money. So I don't know if they can, what states can do at their level beyond a moratorium to help with making actual rent for people in need.
Yeah, I think the government at all levels need to respond, but also state and local municipal governments can't wait, right, for Congress. And so there's already been in Houston, there's something already on the table. I think something needs to be stronger than the grace period ordinance, but that seems to be something that has a lot of consensus right now in the city that the mayor refuses to move on. And so Houston still remains like the only major city in Texas without any kind of housing or eviction protection. And that's something that could be easily put in place. But I don't think we can wait for the federal government to respond. I think the city and the state government can do a lot. And we have also been calling for an expansion of relief money to the communities. But not only through the landlords, but directly to residents, too, so that they don't just get money and the only thing they can do is turn around and pay rent, but that they can also provide for their families as well. We work with the hardest hit communities, which are mostly Black and Brown communities. And so there's also another level of super exploitation that's happening here. And so even before this crisis, people were already having trouble making rent and they were already working for very low wages. And so in order to address that super exploitation that's happening, the workers here, especially we work with a lot of undocumented workers, they need to be able to have like a right to organize together with, you know, other tenants and workers to make sure that the law is followed, that conditions can improve, because even whatever the CARES Act, the federal moratorium that was in place, even the property owners weren't following that as limited as it was. So,
well, you know, Emily, we have about a minute to go. We're talking about sort of emergency measures to stop the bleeding, but really we have to beat the pandemic also. I mean, that's the only long-term way out of this, because in order to provide stability to renters, the economy needs stability too.
Absolutely. And the economy will continue to plummet as long as people are facing eviction. Eviction results in unemployment and it bars people from employment in the future due to the transient nature of eviction and all of the downward effects. I think in the long run, we need to really look at how the pandemic magnified and heightened the socioeconomic divide, health and race disparities, and shredded our already threadbare safety net. And that's the only way through this pandemic, to start lifting up every member of our communities, no matter where they're coming from or what level of socioeconomic they're in, to really address the root causes and ensure that our new post-pandemic reality is one of health justice and racial justice and housing justice.
Well, Emily Benfer is co-creator of the COVID-19 Housing Policy Scorecard with the Eviction Lab at Princeton University and a visiting law professor at Wake Forest. Thank you so much for joining us today, Emily.
Thank you.
And Josephine Lee, organizer with the community-based workers' rights group El Pueblo Primero in Houston. Josephine, thank you. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.